Greetings, friends. Bricky here with another episode of Adventures in Design, and shall I say, returning with more episodes of Adventures in Design. Look, last year I was just repeating everything that I had done in 2021, which didn't give me any sort of opportunity to readjust for the new flow of growing over on YouTube, growing with the podcast. And so therefore, one of the things that I just kind of said, I don't have enough time for everything, was putting up podcasts on this feed, sort of the free feed of Adventures in Design. Well, I took the end of the year off, did a lot of thinking over the fall, and I figured out a way to bring back Adventures in Design over here where you're listening to today. So you can show up every Tuesday and Thursday and find at least 30 minutes of content to help you pursue whatever you're trying to do to turn your daydream into your day job. And a reoccurring theme that seems to keep coming up over and over again with different people I talk to, like today's guest, Christine Belson, who is the president of Sony Pictures Animation. I see this theme a lot and I hear people say it. And a lot of times I'm like, man, they're full of shit. But Christine said it with such conviction. I believed it. And I believed it enough to change so many things in my career this year, because there is something about getting out of our comfort zones, pushing ourselves, and taking on challenges that actually scare us. A part of today's conversation with Christine, we'll be discussing the importance of stepping outside of our comfort zones and facing our fears head on. And literally the way Christine puts it is, I want to do things in my career that scare me, because those are things that excite me. And she talks a lot about the different partners she uses to pick the different titles that Sony Pictures Animation brings over to the silver screen, and coming soon to Netflix. They're now creating series for the streaming screen. You say that three times fast. So whether it's trying something new, taking on a difficult task, or speaking up for ourselves, doing things that scare us often lead to growth, learning, and personal development. And Christine does such a great job of explaining how she's used that method to build a very, very successful animation studio. So often we wonder, why is it that we shy away from these opportunities? If we've heard time and time again, do what scares you, and then it's time to do the thing that scares you, and we all back off of the cliff. Why should we do these things? And how can we overcome our fears to embrace them for opportunities of growth? Well, listen to today's conversation with Christine Belson and find out. Literally inspired me to do a couple of things that I knew that I needed to do, but I was afraid. I was fearful to do them because of the consequences. And now I've realized I need to do these things more than the consequences that may be attached to them. So I'm going to do it, roll the dice, and see where things may lay. Hey, welcome back to Adventures in Design. I'm so happy to have you here. Today's episode is made possible by my friends over at the Circle of Trust, where you can hear the complete conversation with Christine Belson. Let's get started with part one in today's amazing conversation, recorded back at DesignerCon 2022. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to DesignerCon 2022, day two. I'm sitting across from Christine Belson, who is the president of Sony Pictures Animation. Christine, thank you for giving us some time on your Saturday.
Thank you so much. Is this thing on? Can you guys hear me?
We can hear you.
Yes. I'm so excited to be here. This is my first time at DCon, and
yeah?
I'm super stoked. I just got here, so as soon as we're done, I get to go walk the floor.
You're going
to
do your lap?
I'm going to do my lap. I'm going to buy some stuff. I'm really excited.
Well, buy some stuff. I can send you in directions of some people and give you my coupon code. I know you come from a family that was in the entertainment business. Could you imagine being 15-year-old you coming through here through mom and dad and seeing all of this pop culture, all this creativity, and how that would shape your imagination and your track for the rest of your life?
Honestly, no.
Neither can I. I'm so jealous of every kid that's here today.
Like, not at all, because my exposure to the entertainment industry was like sitcoms from the 70s. That's where my intersection, my father was a sitcom writer. So it was nothing like this, and the sort of like explosion of art and celebration of art, and I see it in my adult kids. I have a 23-year-old and a 25-year-old, and the access that they have to art and design,
yeah,
it's like, it's bonkers.
It really is. And when you walk around here today, I think one of the things that you'll enjoy, which is something that you guys did with Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, is just the recycling and reinterpretation of pop culture. You know, because we're now pretty far from the 50s when consumerism and pop culture really came about. Entertainment is now telling us the same stories several different ways, several different actors. So I think you'll, for what you do, I think you'll enjoy the recreation that you see here over and over again. And I'm curious to know, when you first started your entertainment career, you didn't start in animation, right? You were in live action?
That is true. And I'm going to tell you my fascinating history in 1 minute. But I actually want to go back to something you said about like recycling and stuff, because we make movies and series. And one thing that we always sort of, sorry, I have like sweaty upper lip, that we always talk about is, like Richard Nixon, you know, there's no new story under the sun, right? Yeah. And like, sometimes we talk a lot about originality, and we want so badly to be original, but we also love like IP, and in the entertainment industry, everything's so IP-driven now.
Right.
Like, it's way easier to get the animated Spider-Man movie or the animated Ghostbusters movie that we're working on. It's easier to get those made than something truly original. We want to do both. That's very much our agenda at our studio. But my point is, like, it's the reinterpretation that makes things fresh. Like, there are no new stories under the sun. Like, every story's been told. It's just telling it differently.
Right.
And you can take something like Spider-Man, where they've told that story so many different times, and make it fresh all over again. And that's, like, the drill. And it's fun.
I think one of the things that's interesting about a room like DCon, and what you'll enjoy, is there are people here that are taking a crack at making new characters, new stories, building new worlds. But you're so right, and I'd love to get your opinion on this. It almost seems like since the internet explosion, we've gone back and honored stories that were told before the internet explosion, back when you could get everybody's attention. Do you think that we're at a moment now where, I know that you guys do still do original stories, but is it so much harder because the world's moving so much faster to like get that moment where you can get people's attention again on a new project?
My answer to this is a little bit contradictory. Like, on the one hand, you're right. The cycle is so fast. Like, we talk about this a lot in terms of marketing. Like, in the olden days, and by olden days, I literally mean 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, in those olden days, we would talk about like long lead marketing and how you don't try to, how you would try to get something out in the public consciousness like a year in advance and start sowing those seeds. No one does that anymore. It's like, no, let's start talking to the audience about whatever it is literally a month or two out,
right?
Because people can't retain this stuff. So there's that. But on the other side, something that's been discussed a lot is, in the pandemic, everybody stayed home and they watched a lot of stuff, and they watched a lot of storytelling and serialized storytelling, and like they got really engaged in long form stories.
Yes.
And so like both those things are true.
I mean, it's interesting because when you watch, you know, streaming TV and you spend several hours with these characters, and then you go watch a movie that's 90 minutes, you're like, how's she already pregnant? They just met each other yesterday, you know? And the story moves so fast. And in series, you can take your time and sculpt out all those peaks and valleys of storytelling.
And the like, the Marvel thing, it's that's what it's all about, is those are, on a huge scale, that's serialized storytelling that they're doing over like a decade, right?
Whether you're getting it 90 minutes at a time or 10 episodes at 45 minutes at a time.
Yeah, and so for us, yeah, it's actually hard. It's really hard to get all that character storytelling in and animated movies tend to be shorter. So it is hard. So we always are thinking about the next movie, the next chance to tell the story. The dream scenario is the movie and the series that follows, that continues the saga.
So when you're looking at everything laid out in front of you and you're making decisions, because there's only so much money and so much time to, you know, you want to make them all, but you got to pick and choose. How much do you prioritize something that does have that IP growth, where you can see it going into consumer goods, maybe a secondary series, theme park licensing. Like, do you really prioritize something that you feel has those amount of legs?
You know, again, our so many things at our studio in terms of like our mission statement have, well, not so many things. Some things have changed over the years. But something that hasn't changed is we've always said we kind of want to be 50-50, original and IP. We're mostly sticking to it. I think that when you said like you guys are deciding to lean more into IP, like the world is deciding
right.
for us. Like
right.
the my boss, the man who greenlights the theatrical movies, like is he more compelled by something that he knows audiences are already interested in? Absolutely. When we go sell movies or series to streamers, are they having that same concern? Absolutely. And exactly like you said, everybody knows that if a brand already exists,
yeah.
you're going to have an easier time with the ancillary stuff, right? The theme parks, the consumer products. But then to say the obvious thing, if you never do anything original, you'll never start a new piece of IP.
That's
so you
kind of
have
the problem,
to do
right?
both.
Well, it's even interesting because, you know, we're talking about, you know, one of the biggest studios in the entertainment industry of the world, but in these one man shops behind us, which can also be a woman, you will see people will make a ripoff of Mickey Mouse or Spider-Man because it's a proven win that gets people's attention, and then they're trying to slide the original in. So, you know, we're all playing this game, whether it's millions of dollars or thousands of dollars that are on the line. I would love to know, though, when you were in live action and you learned how to manage those projects, how different was it when, I mean, I think your first big one was How to Train Your Dragon. Like, when you walk into that world, how different is animated than live?
So some things are the same. And as you said, started in live action, that I built my career as a live action producer and studio exec. And in some ways, the tenets are the same. A great story is a great story, no matter what, you know, and it's weird. People don't talk this much about taste, but like taste is a real thing, and having mm-hmm. good taste and having the instinct to sort of pick the people that can make great stuff versus people that aren't going to make great stuff is important, whether you're in live action or animation. Character is king, no matter what the medium. But when I was working at the Henson Company, and it was super fun. We were making Muppet movies, which was the best.
Sounds like fun.
It was great. But I was getting increasingly interested in animation because I'd had kids. I had never grown up watching animation. Like most people grew up watching Looney Tunes and all this stuff. I had like a hippie mom. I didn't have a TV. I didn't get to see much
hold
stuff.
Hold on. Your family was doing TV scripts.
No, sorry. Hold on. Divorce.
Oh.
Dad here in LA being a classic LA sitcom writer and everything that you think that might imagine in the
70s. Okay, I was very confused.
And then my mom is like bailed on all that, took baby me, she's Swedish by birth, and was like, we're out of here. And we just started this kind of nomadic hippie existence that lasted for about 10 years.
So you had one foot in Hollywood and one foot in the real world.
Yeah. And not even America, which it sounds snobby, but like I have to say, like it was really helpful growing up and not only understanding this country, but understanding like what people in other places think.
Sure.
But anyway, so started watching animation, started watching Miyazaki movies, and was like, oh my God.
There's a whole world out there.
What the fuck is this? It's so beautiful. It's so extraordinary. And also, Pixar was just starting to fire off, and you're like, what's that about? Why are those movies so good? They're so much better than all the other live action movies. So I got interested, and right around that time, a good friend of mine was at DreamWorks Animation and called up and said, hey, we're looking for somebody to run development. You want to come over here? And I went and started talking to them and realized, man, oh man, I really want to do this. And then I went there and I ran development for a few years and then I transitioned into producing. Here's the thing that I love about animation that is really different from live action. Live action, You work really hard on the script. Now you've got your shooting script. But guess what? You get on set and stuff's different. The environments are different. The actors interpret things a different way. And that's great. I mean, that's part of movie making. But what would invariably happen, at least to me, is we'd be at the end of the day and we'd be like, we're wrapping and we're going to the next location. And I'd be like, no. We're not done. We need to stay here another day. We didn't get it. We didn't get exactly what we wanted. But on live action shoots, you just gotta move on. You'll make it work in the edit room. In animation, it's a lot like workshopping a play. Not like, I haven't done that, but I know what that's like. In animation, we do a script, but we don't sweat the script as much because we know what happens after we get a script that essentially represents the movie is we're going to storyboard the whole thing, we're going to put temporary voices to it, music, we're going to cut it together, and then we get to look at it. Mm. And we get to look at our movie, and which is such a gift, and be like, oh, wow, like, act two is awesome, and it ends strong, but fucking act one is a disaster. We need to fix that, and that those two sequences in act two aren't as good as the rest. And then you get to go in and fix it, and then you get to look at it again, and if you have a nice schedule, you get to do that like, you know, three or four times before you feed production, and it's the best. And that's why those Pixar movies are like, or any good animated movie is like a polished gem.
Right, because you can go in there and just keep massaging it. I was watching the first season of White Lotus on HBO, and I told my wife, I'm like, this show's insane because it's shot in Hawaii, and so many of the scenes are at sunset. You only get an hour and a half to shoot that. I mean, I know you can chase the sun with some of the lenses, but tomorrow's sunset in Hawaii is not going to look like the day before. So I'm sitting there thinking about the production going, oh my God, they're out on the water in the boat. They've got 45 minutes to get all this dialogue in. But if we were animating that, we could get that dialogue perfect. We could get our camera shots. We send it over to somebody else that does our lighting. We can get it glossy. And even still, if we need to add more moment because we've invented that time, we can go back inside of that time.
Right. And actually, it's interesting. I talk about this all the time, how I love the iterative thing, but I never talk about something, and now I'm going to steal that and incorporate it. You're right. We don't have to worry about the textures and the camera angles and the lighting. Like, it's so great to know that there's a later moment when we can work on that. And all we really need to focus on in this first pass is storytelling.
So when you decided to take on Into the Spider-Verse, Sony had already had tremendous success with Spider-Man. I believe it's like 7 of the top 15 movies that Sony's produced.
I'm sure that's true.
So when you touch that, I know it's kind of almost, it's a little bit of an easy win because we know there's an audience, we know that people are into it, but you guys did something so drastically different that we'd never seen before. You know, it was the first feature Marvel animated film. You guys really were ahead of the step of inclusion and diversity and telling the story from so many different perspectives and letting other people see themselves as Spider-Man, which now the movie seems like it makes sense. Kind of a radical thought before the Thanos snap in 2020. So when you were looking at that, how confident were you that this was going to be the win that it was? Because, I mean, everybody wants to win an Oscar. You pick everything hoping that it could, but, I mean, you don't know that until years and years later. But what were you looking at in there that gave you the confidence, let's bet big on this? Because there was some safeties to it, but it was also kind of risking a lot of other factors.
Yeah, I mean, it was scary. It was.
I mean, it's easy to look at that now and go, of course that it worked.
Right.
But pitch that to me when you guys first did that, like, what, 5 years before we saw it?
Right.
It was pretty radical at that moment as it's Spider-Man, but what?
And even now when I look at like the climax of the movie, I'm like, what the hell? Like, that is just so much art. Like, the movie has got just so much art in it. Like, more than a movie normally can hold.
The textures and the way that the scenes go together. It's a moving art project the entire time. And it's mainstream as hell, which is insane. Those two normally don't live in the same universe.
So look, a couple things to say about it is I would say that I think one of the nice things about IP is I think it lets you be a little bit more bold. It kind of gives you a little more license.
You're like, you've already got the audience on your side.
Yeah, we've already got some buy-in. We've already got people rooting for us. So, like, and I sincerely believe, like, whenever we talk anybody at our studio about, like, being bold, it's not because like, oh, we're so cool and we're so bold. It is good business, genuinely. I mean, yes, it is because we want to be bold and we want to surprise ourselves and everything. We don't want to be bored by what we're doing. But I mean, honestly, neither does the audience. Like the audience, it's so obvious. The audience wants stuff that's new and different. But it was scary at times on Spider-Verse because we were pushing so far beyond the normal look of an animated movie. And also not just the look, like it had dramatic intensity that's unusual for a mainstream theatrical animated movie. Like, you know, Miles watches his uncle die from a gunshot in an alley. Like, that's not the normal stuff of an animated film.
Yeah, it's not like Dumbo's mom dipping out. Like,
no.
It's full on murder.
But although, that's actually a good point. Dumbo's mom, like, that's equally intense, right?
Yeah.
Like, so good on you for citing that. But so it was scary in a bunch of different ways, but we had a ton of support from my boss and from the studio, which was amazing. And a lot of it had to do with our producers, Phil Lord and Chris Miller, because these guys are consummate, proven filmmakers. And as producers, they just kept the movie so close and shepherded us through everything. And I think people felt like, if Chris and Phil are here, it's going to be okay.
But as the big boss woman on that project, right? Like, you sign off, we're doing it. What do you look for that gives you that instinct that it's going to be successful? Like, how have you learned to recognize that?
You know, it's such a kind of cheeseball generic answer, but it is true. It is vision. It is some, you know, I say this thing about Chris and Phil, which is that it goes back to the fear thing. If you're not a little bit scared every day by what you're doing, then like maybe you should stay home because like, what's the point? Like if you're not gonna push and try. These guys are so relentless and they are so driven. I actually forgot what the point of the question was, but they just taught me, like, again, just be relentless in the pursuit of excellence. And it's actually funny with them. We literally have to like rip the movie away from them because they will never be done. Like they will want to keep making it better until they die.
That's all of us. We're never done. But see, the way that I reverse engineer that advice is this. You believed in the movie because they believed in it. And so for every creative here, when you're trying to sell somebody on your vision, you can't come in and be soft. You got to tell me this is the best fucking thing you're going to do, and I will kill myself making it great for you.
That's right. And actually, now I remember the question, and what I was going to say is what we look for in filmmakers are people where I'm like, oh, this person is going to be telling me what to do. I'm not going to be telling them what to do. They're going to fucking tell me.
I love
that. And that's what I'm looking for.
So with Sony Pictures Animation, you're in a unique spot, and I want to know how you enjoy this freedom. You're not making content that goes downline to a streaming service, right? Like sometimes it hits cinema. I know you guys have done a deal with Netflix. I know you've created content for Amazon. So much like when you watch some of your favorite sitcoms and you make it to the end, you're like, oh, Warner Brothers makes this, or Sony makes this. So because you don't have like a direct location for things, does that kind of give you freedom to make lots of different projects because you know you've got lots of different partners that are excited to buy different products?
Yes, and I have always maintained, and back when I was at DreamWorks, I used to say this to my boss, and I don't think he agreed with me, but I would always say, like, I don't think the brand is DreamWorks. I think the brand is Kung Fu Panda. I think the brand is How to Train Your Dragon.
I love that.
Pixar and Disney, that's a brand. That's different. They have achieved...
But it's built for that, right?
It's built for that, and it's been 100 years in the making. I mean, we didn't make Dumbo. They did. Like, there's a legacy there that puts them in a very different place, and you can say, oh, I want to go see the latest Pixar or Disney movie. I don't think anybody says, I want to go see the latest Sony Pictures animation movie. I don't
know. No, because they look at it as the IP.
Correct.
That drives them there.
I want them to say, like, I want to go see, you know, that new, you know, we're making a really cool movie about K-pop. Like, I want everyone to be like, I want to go see that crazy animated K-pop movie. So the whole thing, if you don't believe that we need to have a house style, which we don't. We're like anti-house style. It's a huge point of pride for us that if you look at this like little timeline thing, like if it didn't say Sony Animation, you'd be like, this didn't come from the same place.
What ties all these together?
Yeah, there's nothing that ties it all together, except we got excited about these things.
Friends, I hope you are enjoying this conversation as much as I did. I just found Christine, out of all the big top level Hollywood people I've talked to before, she seemed by far like the most fucking legit person I'd ever spoke to. At first, I was a little bit intimidated. Her energy is very, very excitable. And sometimes excitable people are hard to get focus in conversations. I said, oh no, this might be a hard one. But man, oh man, what a dance partner she was. I just had so much fun talking to Christine. I hope I get to have another conversation with her again, because this really was, I know the best conversation I've had with somebody at this level. Just her openness, her ability to express, like, these are the things I get right, these are things I get wrong, this is where I want to improve. Like, it just was like talking to one of my buds. And that's amazing when you can be that down to earth, when you have a job that's kind of that big of a deal. To hear the rest of this conversation, head over to AID.network, become a member of the Circle of Trust, help me keep putting the podcast together, and help keep bringing conversations like this one to each and every one of you. What do you say? Let's get started with a teaser on part two that's available exclusively for members of the Circle of Trust over at AID.network.
And see, what I hear from that is you guys have a lot of freedom that you get to reinvent yourself for the project. Whereas think about all the things that are probably a good idea at Disney or Pixar, and I'm a huge fan, but it has to click all the way down line. If it doesn't make sense as merchandise on Main Street USA, it's not gonna go the whole way. Whereas I know you guys are doing your first R-rated series for Netflix. I kept hearing them talk about it in meetings for DCON. They kept saying, King, King, King. I never realized it was my king, Elvis Aaron Presley.
Yes,
ooh,
indeed.
I am fired up. Look at that man. He's so handsome. He looks like Batman Beyond.
He is so handsome. And when you have the amazing character designer, Rob Valley, put his spin on Elvis, it is very sexy.
He's a good looking man. So what some of these people want to know, and people that will listen to this and watch it at home, is so many people that are illustrators and animators, you know, obviously they would love to get on your radar. And as I've interviewed lots of people that are in your position or parallel positions, I keep hearing we're looking for world builders. We want people that can build a world or a character that belongs inside of, you know, a universe that we can buy into and believe. When people are trying to attempt that, because it's like such great advice, but so broad, like, oh, just make something everybody would love. No problem. Let me make Mickey Mouse. Done. So when you're looking, when you're walking around and you're looking at new artists or new people that are creatives, what do you think makes that world or that character intoxicating to somebody like yourself?
Well, I was going to say what makes it extra hard is you're not just looking for somebody to create a cool world that you want to spend time in. You're also looking for somebody with like a super compelling character story. So we always say we're looking for somebody to come in with a story that is deeply personal to them. Like, I really want to tell a story about these characters for this reason, because it means this to me, but also through that personal storytelling, it could actually universally speak to others, because whatever, the human condition, we're all kind of going through the same thing, right? And you know, I always say, like, all movies are, not all, but to a large degree, so many movies are just about, you know, the search for love and feeling loved. But at the same time, yeah, it's got to have like the bells and whistles, and you want to transport people to some place that they've never been. Now, that could be like with the Mitchells versus the Machines.
Yeah.
So much of that movie, eventually we went to like a big old, you know, set PC kind of environment in the end. But the first two acts of that movie were set in like real America, and we really wanted to show the realness of things. We talked a lot bizarrely about the Roseanne show and how that show and All in the Family, how those shows kind of uniquely showed like how people actually lived, and how whitewashed animated movies in particular, just how animated movies have whitewashed, like, you'd think everybody was like white and lived in a, like a comfortable suburban existence, and you never show anything else. So my point about all that being is it doesn't necessarily have to be a world like in outer space or a fantasy world. It can be like, hey, I want to show our world. I want to show, you know, people who go to Walmart and buy the extra large, you know, paper towel roll and have to keep it in the corner of their bedroom because they don't have a pantry to keep it in. Like, I want to show that, and I want to do it with this kind of detail. That actually is bringing people somewhere they haven't been before, believe it or not.
You know, twice now I've kind of hit you up with the advice, you know, how do people break in? And you keep giving it to me in a way I haven't heard it before, where it sounds like you really believe in the artist and their vision. And, you know, I've been given this advice when I try to, you know, do these interviews and empower the audience, but I'm really enjoying how much you say that it's got to be personal to them. Because I think a lot of times, you know, we're trained as artists, like, well, just do the best work possible and that will do everything for you. But I'm loving your version of, but also put you in there, like tell your own story of love and heartache. And if you tell it so authentically you, it will resonate with other people.
I absolutely, absolutely believe that. Mitchell's is a great example of that. That was a really personal story to Mike Rianda. And the fact that it meant so much to him, you know, making movies is hard. Animated movies take forever. We joke about the fact that, like, we're sprinting, but we have to sprint for, like, four. It's like marathon sprinting. We have to sprint for, like, years and years. So, like, if you have that passion, like, that personal passion, it makes you... It just drives you to do better and try harder, and I think it's super important. A movie that I thought was so great was Turning Red. Such a great personal, like, super entertaining for a mainstream audience, but expression of a really personal story.
So when you guys are doing the deal with Netflix and you're doing The King and it's a series, are you enjoying looking at the whiteboard and being like, okay, so here are all of our episodes, and this is how we're going? Like, I think that creative process of, we don't have to get it perfect in 90 minutes. We have several episodes, several hours to tell the story. Do you enjoy finding the rhythm, almost like putting a record together, you know? You come out swinging, you do your hit as number two. Number three, you bring it down a little bit. Four is an album cut. Five, it's got to be good, so they flip the record over. You know, there's a way that albums are laid out. You know, normally on TV shows, that second to last one is the one that punches you in the gut because the next one is the setup for season number two. So are you enjoying that roller coaster of storytelling?
100%, and I love, you obviously know what you're talking about in terms of the kind of cadence.
Oh, I'm just a great bullshitter.
You're good. in terms of the cadence of that, but because I like to be honest, it's hard. Like, what you're describing is like luxurious, and you have the time to sit and look back and get
it's
it just
gritty,
right. Well, series is so fast paced. That's the thing I find it very exciting for the reasons that you're saying, but challenging because you're like, you got to figure it out right now, and we don't have the same amount of iterating time that we have on the movie, so we got to be really smart and strategic. And even though you planned all the stuff that you describe, it doesn't always turn out that way. You're like, dang, episode 7 turns out maybe isn't one of our best episodes. I think the thing that was the biggest thing I had to learn, and all my friends who worked in TV were like, look me in the eye and understand this, or you will die trying to make series. They're not all the Emmy award-winning episode. Some are going to be great.